Good afternoon. I'd like to call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, March 24th. Let the record reflect that it is 1:31 p.m. With us today, we have Vice Chair Senator Schauer, Senator Hughes, Senator Myers, and Senator Keel. And as usual, we want to thank my staff, Kelly, Nancy, and Alex. You guys do a great job in here. We really appreciate it. We're going to go ahead and dive right into the agenda because today every minute matters. So we have three important things on the agenda today. We try to do appointees first in this committee because people often have busy schedules for the appointees. And so we have Attorney General Treg Taylor. Then we're going to have Senate Bill 9, Alcohol Beverage Control, by Senator McChickie. And we want to welcome you to the committee today. Thank you for being here. And then we have H.J.R. 1, a constitutional amendment for the permanent fund dividend. So busy schedule. The reason we had to pack today is because there's town halls this weekend, and so we tried to. I told you guys Mondays and Wednesdays we're going to be having very, very busy Judiciary Committee hearings. So, with that, Treg Taylor, would you please come and take the hot seat? So welcome to the Judiciary Committee. Thank you for coming before us today. We do appreciate it. And as I said, it's your brave man today. So as you know the routine very well, please state your name, your affiliation, where you're from, and tell us just a little bit about yourself and why you think that the governor has chosen you to take this important position.
Happy to do that. Good afternoon, Chair Ryan Bolden, to the rest of the esteemed members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. I don't think I've been in a room this full other than an airplane for well over a year, so it's a great feeling. It's good to see people here and interested in such important topics that we're probably going to discuss today in my confirmation hearing. So it's a pleasure to be here before you today, and I appreciate all of your willingness to meet with me individually prior to this hearing. My name is Treg Taylor, and I'm honored that the governor has asked me to serve as Alaska's Attorney General. I want to give you kind of an overview of who I am and what led me to be in front of you today, so that you better understand what makes me tick. I grew up in southern Alberta, Canada. For several years, my family lived in the First Nations Blood Indian Reservation, the largest First Nations reservation in Canada, as both my parents taught in the school district. We later moved to a small community next to the reservations, but my parents continued to teach in the school district. While I never became conversant in Blackfoot, because my native friends did not only spoke English, my little sister's first words and sentences were in Blackfoot. I have fond memories of the reservation gatherings, of eating, dancing, and singing at the powwows. I learned during that time a deep respect for the culture and traditions that were different than my own. I was even given the Indian name of Dirty Moccasin. I had a habit of running around the neighborhood covered in dirt, so I think that's where I got that moniker. I've always been drawn to public service, and growing up, my dream was to fly fighters for the United States Air Force. I know, seems like an odd dream for a Canadian kid, but my hero and my role model throughout my life has been my grandfather, who flew bombers during for the U.S. Army Air Corps during World War II. Coincidentally, he was stationed in Alaska twice, once after the war doing cold weather testing for the B-29s, and then once later on as an attorney for the U.S. State Department. My father was a boy when my grandpa was stationed in Alaska, but he has vivid memories of selling newspapers along 4th Avenue and collecting fossils at Government Hill. For my grandfather, I knew that to live my dream, I would need stellar grades and excellence in my extracurricular activities. I went to work. That dream kept me out of a lot of trouble. After my parents divorced, I moved to Iowa with my mom during my middle school years and my first year of high school. I finished high school in Utah and applied to and was accepted to the United States Air Force Academy. That was an exciting day of my life. I was living my dream. My first year was predictably difficult, although looking back, some of the fondest memories that I have occurred during that hard year. Near the end of the academic year, my class was what we termed recognized, which means we were finally treated as equals among the cadet corps. The second year is largely thought to be the hardest academic year because you start your core required courses. After your second year, the academy allows cadets to serve religious missions. I opted to serve a mission for my church along with 28 other cadets. I was assigned to labor and serve in the Canary Islands. That's two provinces of Spain, little islands off about 40 miles off the coast of Morocco. Like my time on the First Nations Indian Reservation, during those 2 years on the islands, I learned to love a people and a culture different than my own. I also found great joy in serving others. Near the end of my mission, I reapplied to the academy and was accepted back. They sent me a one-page document that I needed to sign and send in my reacceptance and appointment. I went to sign it and couldn't. For 2 weeks, I tried to sign that document. I wanted so badly to return to the academy. I absolutely loved my time there, and I was so close to living my dream of flying fighters and serving my country. It was a hard 2 weeks. I felt guilty because here I was supposed to be serving the people of the Canary Islands, and all I could think about was this decision. I couldn't sleep. I was miserable. One morning, exhausted, I fell to my knees and frustratedly declared to God, "Fine, I'll do what you want me to do." I didn't know why, but I knew immediately what I was supposed to do, and the academy was not part of that plan. Within a few weeks of returning home, I found one very good reason why. That's when I met my wife, Jody. When we first met, I was very interested in getting to know her better. However, she wasn't at all interested in getting to know me. 22 years of marriage later, I still strive each day to convince her that she made a good choice. You'll have to ask Jody how I'm doing. We now have 6 children, 5 girls, Quincy, London, Romy, Roxy, and Callie, and I have 1 son, Gage. Our oldest daughter is now married and attending BYU. Her apartment is just blocks from the hospital where she was born while Jody and I were undergrads. And our youngest is 10 months as of yesterday and crawling around the house. After we were married, Jody and I worked several summers in Alaska to put ourselves through school, and I had fallen in love with her home state. Near the end of law school, I asked Jody where she wanted me to look for permanent work. She replied, "Anywhere but Alaska." She had lived in Alaska her whole life and wanted to experience something new. We identified a few cities we would like to live, and I earnestly began looking for work. However, a few months into it, nothing seemed to be working out. We decided we need to expand my search to additional cities and made it a matter of prayer. A few days later, I came home and she announced she knew where I was supposed to look. She explained that that whole day, she couldn't keep a certain song out of her head. Then she sang, "8 Stars of Gold on a Field of Blue, Alaska's Flag, May It Mean to You." I couldn't have been happier. As it was, we were already returning to Alaska 2 weeks later to attend her sister's wedding. At the reception, I met a gentleman who indicated he knew of a firm that might be hiring. I reached out to the firm the next day and within 2 hours was sitting in front of them for an interview. They offered me a position on the spot. Jody and Quincy stayed in Alaska while I returned for finals and then drove up the Alcan in our Hyundai Elantra that luckily fit everything Jody and I owned. At Delisio Moran, Garrity & Zobel, I primarily worked with Mike Garrity, who eventually became the state's attorney general. My practice largely consisted of business litigation defense. During this time, we represented the state, the municipality, energy companies, and many other Alaskan businesses. After about 5 years at Delisio, I received a call from McKinley Capital Management to see if I was interested in coming in-house. That idea appealed to me as I had played team sports through college, and I wanted to work more in a team atmosphere. I felt like I was sort of a hired gun in the litigation firm. During my time at McKinley, we entered the Great Recession. And one of my primary responsibilities was to help the company navigate the rapidly changing investment management regulatory schemes throughout the world. I next accepted a position as senior corporate counsel at ASRC Energy Services, where I acted as in-house counsel for about 8 oil and gas service companies. During that time, the price of oil plunged, and I helped these companies navigate through this very difficult time. After about 5 years at ASRC, the governor asked me to serve as the deputy attorney general over the civil division. I have now been at the attorney general's office for a little over 2 years. My wife and I have made it a priority to be involved in and to serve in the community. We have had many wonderful experiences as a family doing so, and as we have served, we have become keenly aware of some of the issues facing Alaska families. Highlights of what I learned include the following. Jody and I helped bring the Living Legends, a Native American, Polynesian, and Hispanic origin dance group, to the Performing Arts Center in Anchorage and provided a free concert to local school children, including students from the Alaska Native Charter School and the Alaska Military Youth Academy. The director of the Youth Academy later told us that the event was very powerful for the minority cadets and that some of them had expressed to him that it was the first time that they had felt proud of their minority heritage. That was a stunning revelation for Jody and I, and for Jody and me, and is one area I intend to address at every opportunity. Another example of what I learned is after realizing that our oldest daughter, that ACT prep classes, due to cost, were outside the realm for many Alaskan families. We helped organize a free multi-day ACT prep camp with an emphasis on inviting minority students, including Alaska Natives. It is amazing what a few extra points on the ACT can do for opportunities and for scholarships. What I learned was that businesses, community organizations, and individuals are ready and willing to help in an effort to fill this and other needs in our community. For example, when we asked one Alaska business to donate a day's lunch, they replied no. They wanted to donate all of the needed lunches. Another time we helped organize a food drive that ended in a community event at Shiloh Baptist Church. One booth we helped with told the survivor stories of many Alaskans who have been sexually assaulted or abused, some of whom expressed that this was the first time they had felt heard and validated. From this experience, I learned the importance of being heard in the healing process of survivors of sex crimes. Finally, my wife and I also helped organize and participate in a group made up of LGBT community leaders and religious leaders from various denominations to address several issues. For well over a year, we met regularly to work on these issues. I learned from this experience that individuals from very different backgrounds and sometimes preconceived notions can work together for a common good, but that it takes time and effort. But mostly it takes listening. At the end of January, when the governor asked if I'd be willing to serve as the state's next attorney general, my first thoughts turned to Alaska's ignominious ranking as the worst state for sex crimes. I think many of you have seen this slide presented at the by the Criminal Division that shows that not only does Alaska have the highest rate of sex crimes, our rate is almost double that of the next state, Arkansas. I see this slide in my mind every day, and I am determined to do everything within my power to address this epidemic in our state. If I don't use the full authority of this office to seek out and find justice for victims of sex crimes, and I have failed to do my duty, and I have failed the people of this great state. I truly believe that until this scourge is rooted out, and our mothers, wives, sisters, and children feel protected and safe, we are hobbled as a state. I am under no illusion that this is an easy problem to address, and I know that many efforts have been made in the past and are ongoing, but I know that I must try. If my attempts fail, I will keep going back to the drawing board and try again. Jody constantly reminds our children to lift where they stand, and they can make the world a better place. I promise you, as the Attorney General, I will lift where I stand to make Alaska a better place for all Alaskans. Thank you.
Okay, so there's a series of questions. First, I was not really planning on doing this, but to follow my own rules, usually I ask questions about political involvement and political engagement at the end when I'm doing appointees, but I have to be straight up. I helped with your campaign for school board in my own living room. So that was, I believe, 2008. Is that when you ran for school board?
I believe that was, yes.
Okay. So I just felt like it was appropriate to get that, and I do know your wife as well. So she's a wonderful, wonderful person, and I just realized we have another connection, Canary Islands. I used to live in Norway, and we went to Canary Islands quite often. I even spent a Christmas there. So anyway, that's pretty intriguing. That's one thing I did not know about you. I have a series of questions that I need to ask. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead. Usually I let the committee members start first, but because my list is quite extensive, I'm going to ask a few. Then I'm going to move around to the committee members, and I may have to switch to a shield that I can tolerate better, because I definitely do not tolerate this well. But I'm going to start with the very first question. If confirmed to the position of Attorney General for the state of Alaska, do you understand yourself to be employed by the governor or the people of Alaska?
I'll answer that question. I took an oath a few days after the governor asked me to be the Attorney General. In that oath, I swore an oath to the U.S. Constitution and to the Constitution of Alaska. And the Alaska Constitution starts out, "We the people of Alaska." So ultimately, my oath is to the people of Alaska. Am I employed by the state at the behest of the governor? That is also true.
Okay, so you will be working for the people of Alaska?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you. Important question. In regards to what is your opinion when it comes to the emergency powers of the executive branch? Do you believe, if shaped narrowly for a short time, that the civil liberties of Alaskans can be infringed on for the greater good of Alaskans?
Chair Reinbold, that's a great question, and I believe that the Alaska Disaster Act has allowed, maybe not particularly designed for what we've seen over this extended period. I think it was probably principally designed for acts such as an earthquake or acute things that happen over a very short time, and allows him to respond, the governor or whoever the governor is, he or she, to respond very rapidly to that situation. Obviously, it's a clunky tool to be used over an extended epidemic, but that's the tool that the governor had, and I do believe that that act gives the governor broad authority to respond to that epidemic.
Okay, so did
I fully answer your question? Sorry,
you did not. Okay, so I'm gonna ask it in a different way. I spoke with you this summer, as you know, regarding all the mandates. You know, I had tremendous concerns with them. You've seen the binder. I got 13 of them, but you've seen the big one that I've got tabbed. And basically, you said that it was passed through you for constitutional concerns. Is that correct? I want to make sure that you affirm that is the truth, that I contacted you.
Those mandates, before they were put to the public, I was given a short opportunity to review them for any obvious constitutional issues or legal issues.
Okay, so now I'm going to ask the question again. What is your opinion when it comes to the emergency powers of the executive branch? Do you believe, if shaped narrowly as the mandates, for a short time, that civil liberties of Alaskans can be infringed upon for the good of Alaskans, yes or no?
Yes. I believe that's the intent of the Disaster Act, is to give the governor the authority to take action that sometimes infringes on individual civil liberties, the idea being for a short period and for the good of Alaska.
Okay, Senator Hughes has a follow-up to that.
It's related to that. And as you mentioned, the statutes were written with a short-term type disaster in mind. Would you be open, and would you advise the governor, if we were to work on those statutes and make them more appropriate, for instance, for something involving a health matter where the powers would not be so broad, where we might be able to weigh in as a legislature to create checks and balances as far as the mandate could last for a certain amount of time, and then we as a legislature would decide whether it would end or continue. Would you think that would be appropriate, and is that something that you would advise the governor to support?
Senator Hughes, through the chair, I think after any use of the disaster declaration, it's good to go back, look at what was done right, what was done wrong. How do we better account for what happened? I think, given the situation, this epidemic was a matter of sort of first impression in the state of Alaska. It would be wise and fully within the duty of the legislature to review that act very carefully, and to suggest changes, and present those changes to the governor. And I would support that effort.
Thank you.
Just a minute, Senator Hughes. It is in regards to this, because I have one more before I'm moving. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for being with us, Attorney General Designee, Mr. Taylor. I think as we've talked in the past, I've expressed concern about the serial disaster declarations that we had. I guess the question's in two parts. It strikes me that there is a separation of powers issue, that the legislature delegated the authorities that you and the chair discussed to the governor, and reserved to itself the ability to pass on how long those might be in effect. And what we saw was a series of declarations that first there was the risk, then there was the presence, then there was the presence again, or I should say extended for the presence, then there was a presence again. Then we had, the opportunity to address concerns was a condition of disaster declaration, and I think in January there just wasn't any reason given at all. So I guess the question comes to whether you see separation of powers issues with the approach, and how would you advise a future governor if not to convene the legislature after 30 days as to the constitutionality of serial disaster declarations?
Well, Senator Keel, through the chair, while I hope that we never face such an epidemic again, at least give us a break from that type of thing, I do believe this is entirely a separation of powers issue, and the act as written, the Disaster Act as written, gives the authority of the governor to institute a disaster declaration for a 30-day period, and that's exactly what the governor did. Now, is it a policy concern from the legislature that he utilized that authority under the act multiple times in a row? Yeah, I mean, that definitely could be something that the legislature takes a look at and makes a decision, a policy call on, and maybe amends the act to address that situation.
Quick follow-up. Thank you. So the act as written and on the books now limits one declaration per condition. So in a hypothetical where the geologists warned us that 17 volcanoes across Alaska were going to go off and you had a disaster declaration and the legislature didn't convene, 30 days later, could you have a new disaster declaration because of the volcanoes having gone off, and 30 days after that, a new disaster declaration because there was still ash around?
Senator Keel, through the chair, I mean, that's the type of problem that we're talking about, right, that the act is sort of an imperfect tool for what occurred. And under the plain reading of that act, you know, the governor does have that ability to declare that declaration for 30 days. And in an epidemic that occurs over a period of a year and a half, there obviously is ups and downs in that epidemic. There's a need to constantly monitor what is going on in the ground, make decisions related to that. And so, you know, given the changing circumstances, given the authority, given the governor in that act, he had the authority to declare those additional declarations. On that same authority, the House and the legislature could call themselves into session, and they could have acted on those disaster declarations. Do I think that's the best way to go about it, to continually declare those a new disaster declaration? No, I would hope that between you and the governor in the next coming months that you could come up with a way to address that issue, because I do believe it's an issue, and I do believe it's a hole in the disaster declaration that should be addressed by this body and the executive.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and jump in here. Do you believe that laws should be arbitrarily applied where winners and losers are chosen?
Senator Reinbold, that's a great question, and I, that's sort of law is sort of a double-edged sword in that aspect. I mean, every law sort of chooses winners and losers. A law governing the ability to, for example, open a taxi service required certain things, and by the very enumerated elements of that requirement, certain people are allowed to open a taxi service and certain other people are not. That's just by the very nature of what you do as a legislative body, as you take those policy considerations into account and try to create a law that is fair and equitable to all Alaskans.
Okay, and I'm gonna drill down. I want to stay focused on the disaster declaration. You picked essential and non-essential. What is your opinion in regards to picking essential and non-essential and the arbitrary application of how the mandates were applied?
Senator Reinbold, through the chair, that was a policy decision, and I don't have an opinion as the Attorney General on that policy call.
Okay, so I'm going to ask it a different. Do you believe that the executive branch should be setting policies picking essential and non-essential workers?
Senator Reinbold, I think that given the nature of the epidemic, there were had to be tough calls made, and the governor chose to make those calls. And as the duly elected governor of this state, obviously he answers to the voters of this state, and we'll see how the voters react to his policy calls in the next election.
Okay, so I'm going to ask the question in a little bit different way. Do you believe law should be equally, or do you believe they should be arbitrarily applied. Is there a place for arbitrary application?
Senator Reinbold, I think that the ideal law is going to be fair and equitable to all people. And so anything that varies from that ideal is a policy call that I simply can't comment on.
Okay, and you understand that it was arbitrarily applied, correct?
Senator Reinbold, I don't know about the title arbitrary. I believe that there was a lot of discussion, I'm imagining, at the executive level that involved the positives and negatives of certain actions, and that they took the action that they thought best served Alaskans.
Okay, and so basically you believe that law should not be applied arbitrarily. Is that what you're stating?
Senator Reinbold, I believe my role as the Attorney General is to apply the law and to defend the law when it's challenged. That's my role as the Attorney General. I don't make policy calls about a law. That's not my job. That's not my role. I simply defend the law, and that's what I do.
And do you believe these mandates are law?
Senator Reinbold, through the chair, Senator Reinbold, you are the chair. I think that under the Alaska Disaster Declaration, that the act, that these mandates had the effect of law.
Okay. Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two things. First one, I just want to clarify and point brief, because the question came out, this question, before I could get to it, is that when the comment was made previously that you had the chance for the legislature to call itself into session, that's a valid point. However, I want to continue to highlight this, that many of us were not contacted as legislators and given that option. I think many of us would have liked to have come in and done that, but this is based on what happened, previous leadership, relationships, things that weren't going that well. Many of us were not given that opportunity, and that might have been a chance for us to fix this and not be here now. So I just think it's important that we keep that on the record. The second thing, I think to maybe drill down a little bit just from where you're seeing some of the angst from some of the legislators, is that what happened, and I know you're aware of this, but getting it back out for the record again, is that in many cases, even if it wasn't maliciously done, maybe there were cases where it was, where the mandates, and you've just answered that you believe they have the effect of law, they were not necessarily equally applied. And you saw this, and we've talked about it. So it's just something I think that's important, that it comes up from a discussion. As legislators, we have to respond to the people we represent. And in many cases, we had certain government agencies or agents of the government were going around and saying, if you don't shut down, we're going to do X. We're going to pull your liquor license. We're going to do this to you, whatever. So many business owners and others felt like they were unfairly targeted and could not operate, and some of them went out of business. So that's just it's a result of what happened as we get into the breakdown. And I think that's a lot of what you're seeing here, is that you see, you know, when a marijuana shop, for example, can stay open, but a mom and pop shop for something else can't, based on how things are playing out, or maybe a church was threatened. If you have people in there, they're going to, you know, say things if they have too many people based on capacity. Whether it's a home rule city or state is irrelevant. Is part of the discussion that we're talking about, that I think that you see this concern from legislators that have to then talk to their citizens and tell them, sorry, I know that this affects you in a certain way. So I think the answer, as we circle around all of this, is getting back to the on track, moving forward. And you said something that's very important to me, and I guess this isn't so much a question as a comment, is that we debrief. Talked about fighters, and you know, we've had that conversation, obviously the background I have. When something happens, every mission, call this a mission, you debrief. And the debrief is brutal. It's brutal for a reason, because you want to find out what you did right, what you did wrong. There's no rank in the debrief. A second lieutenant has every right to talk to a four-star general. And it doesn't matter if it's the governor, the attorney general, or a legislator, whoever it is. We should be able to debrief what happened, like you said. And the important thing now is moving forward. What do we do moving forward? We need to take a look at the statutes. We need to take a look at what happened, fix it, because this won't be the last time. It won't be. So next time, how are we going to do it better? So I think, just to kind of circle all this, moving on to this, is that's where you're seeing some of the angst from, my understanding, is that what I think we want to know is that moving forward, we're going to be able to debrief this and learn from it, and are you going to support that effort to help us get to a point next time something happens? Hopefully it didn't take place like this one, and we do it better. Does that make sense?
Senator Schauer, through the chair, I absolutely agree. I think that's going to be a critical thing for the legislature and the executive to do, is have those discussions, have that debrief, come up with fixes in the Disaster Act and do what hopefully will result in a better outcome, or at least a better process next time we face something like this in our state.
And one follow-up, it's a very brief.
Okay, go ahead.
Just to answer to Senator Ramble's question, I think part of what she asked is relevant, and it sounds like you said it, but again, on the record, you support that effort for the legislature to assert its duties, which is to look at these things, find those lessons, and fix them so we don't do it again. You're not in opposition to that. You support that, correct?
Senator Schauer, through the chair, absolutely. I support that effort.
Senator Deese.
Yeah, and just to comment on that, because I mentioned earlier and brought up the same thing, appreciate Senator Schauer's remarks and that the disaster statutes weren't designed for an extended period. And part of what I would like to see, and I hope that you would support it and the governor would support it, is as we recraft those to work better next time, is that we always take into an account the economic impact as well as the health impact. And that, I think, would solve some of the problems where the angst that we're hearing from residents back home is, and even in the debriefing, the briefing and press conferences that the governor had, for instance, where Dr. Zink was before, I would have loved to have seen someone that would have been representing the economic side, and so that we could bring that into balance. I think that is something I would like to see, and I would hope that you and the governor would support such a incorporation into the statutes to make sure that we stay afoot. You know, it is one thing to keep everybody healthy, but if the economy goes down the drain, it's not good. Thank you.
Absolutely, I totally agree. There's been a lot. The kids are struggling, as you well know. A lot of businesses. I heard over 80 businesses went out of business in Anchorage. I mean, Anchorage. Eagle River's in the municipality of Anchorage. It's been tough. I know you live there too, but so that's a really good point, Senator Hughes. I appreciate that. So I'm going to jump on to religious liberties. Did you have something to do? Did you also review the state health alerts?
I may have, Senator Reinbold. I may have seen a few of those. I don't believe I was a required reviewer for those.
Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and jump into those. I thought when we talked this summer, you did review them as well as the mandates. But I just want to make sure that it's on the record. State alert number 10, of course, concerned me. It's in regards to cloth face coverings. This was back April 3rd, so almost a year ago. And as you can see, everybody in the room pretty much has one on. And basically, it was recommended that Alaska makes their own face cloth coverings and wear them in public where it's difficult to maintain social distancing. Well, as you know, in the building, we have negative tests. We still have to wear these. And they referred to a July 22nd, 2020 mandatory face coverings by the governor. Is that still in place?
Senator Reinbold, the governor's never had a statewide mandatory face covering mandate in the state of Alaska.
Correct. That's not what I said, because he says he's never issued a statewide. That was not my question. My question is the mandate in state buildings that he issued on July 22nd still in place?
Senator Reinbold, I believe that is still in place.
Okay, so there is a statewide face covering mandate in state buildings.
Senator Reinbold, that's correct.
Okay, so I just thought, just a point of interest, my church had to have face coverings on. I guess it was ridiculous in my mind, you know, because to me it violated religious liberty. So I had a real problem with that. So I left the church actually over that. But the bottom line here is it says on your health alert said, do not remove face coverings until you return home. You know, so you had to have your face covering on health alert. And then it has all these issues of how to put together an Easter basket and how to interact with your clergymen, and you had to have your face covered and all this. It was kind of a shocker, you know, doing all this. But what is your opinion on infringing on religious liberties and directing churches what to do, what they can and cannot do, and how many can gather and how many cannot?
Senator Reinbold, I believe that, like any protected class of individual, and religious freedom certainly falls in, religious liberty certainly falls within that there should be a heightened scrutiny applied, which is exactly what the courts do. They apply that heightened scrutiny. They look to make sure what has occurred. If this was going to be evaluated before a court of law, they're going to make sure that there was a clear state interest, and then they're going to look to make sure that the state's interest, the way that the act or the declaration or the mandate was narrowly tailored to address that interest, and that interest was great enough to infringe on a person's religious freedom, if that be the case, or any of the other protected things that we hold dear as citizens of this country and residents of the state.
So yes or no, can the First Amendment religious liberties be infringed upon?
Senator Reinbold, like any of those liberties, there are times when those can be infringed upon.
Because, as you know, there was a limited number of how many people could congregate, what they had to have on their face, all that kind of stuff. Did you support that as Attorney General?
Senator Reinbold, again, that's not my policy call. I don't do the policy calls. I just support those calls under the law. And for example, with freedom of speech, obviously we all know the anecdotal, you can't yell fire in a full theater, right? So there's certain limitations that the courts have found that state actors have the ability to sort of curtail some of those religious freedoms. And do I think that that's a wise option that that states have? And I think we just with that example, that's sort of a wise policy. It's part of our separation of powers, and that the courts ultimately get to make the decision that the legislative act, the law that you enacted, doesn't overly burden those freedoms that we enjoy as Americans and as residents of Alaska. And so giving those checks and balances, there are sometimes infringement on our freedoms.
Just a quick comment, Madam Chair.
Okay, go ahead.
I just want to make clear for those listening that there was no mandate that people wear cloth masks in churches. And what was referred to was an alert, which was suggestions for those that might want to choose to follow those, and those were not mandated. Thank you.
There actually were hundreds of times where he mentions cloth face covering, either in his press or in here. So, you know, we can see things a little differently. Bottom line is the next thing, it says, have you looked under the settled law in the Supreme Court cases as it pertains to the current events and the executive branch mandates to evaluate if those mandates are applied lawfully in the best interest of the state of Alaska, such as the Juho versus Williamson?
Senator Reinbold, could you please repeat that question? I missed the first part of that.
So have you looked into settled law, so let's Supreme Court cases, as it pertains to current events and executive branch mandates to evaluate if those mandates are applied lawfully and in the best interest of the state of Alaska? My example to you, first example, is Juho versus Williamson.
Senator Reinbold, when I had that short time period to review each of those mandates as it came through, that was the time that I had to look at those to see whether or not they were constitutional, whether they overly infringed on rights. And obviously there's a certain amount of policy call to that, but any obvious infringement, any obvious conflict with any settled law, any decision of the Alaska Supreme Court or the U.S. Supreme Court, then that was the purpose of my review, was to make that review.
Madam Chair, may I ask relevant to your question?
This is kind of important to drill down on this, so go ahead.
So this is relevant. So I'm asking it in a different way because I am interested in even the previous topic there a moment ago, but I'll stick on this one for now, is knowing your background and what you believe, because what you believe is often how we rule, whether it's as a legislator or attorney general or governor. You know, your background, religious or otherwise, does bias the decisions we make, and hopefully we can rise above that to do the right thing at the right time, understood. But I am interested if, as we've had this discussion here, were due process rights, in your opinion, because you would be advising the governor on decisions that he would make, these policy calls, as you're calling them, do you see that due process rights were protected during that time when we know that certain businesses were kind of impacted and things happened? We got that, whether it was unequally applied, another conversation. But there were some businesses that were arbitrarily basically closed down. And, you know, talking about the 14th Amendment, I would be interested to know your opinion on how those things should have been applied or may have been applied, because how you would, what you believe, and how you would, moving forward, advise the governor would be very important. And I think that's a lot of what these questions drill to. What would you advise him on, and how this played out? Back to those lessons learned, moving forward, what would you say? Because that's, I think, of great interest to us, on what you would advise the governor on how he would do those things. Because I will tell you, not all of it was done great, and I think we can all acknowledge we can do better. So relative to the 14th Amendment due process rights, your thoughts?
My thoughts on the 14th Amendment and due process rights is that specifically sort of what is the subject of the Alaska Disaster Act. It removes some of those due process rights in order to address an impending epidemic, an impending disaster, earthquake, whatnot. And so by the very nature of the act, it sort of removes some of those due process safeguards that we enjoy on a day-to-day basis under normal situations. Does that answer your question?
Madam Chair, clarify. Thank you. So let's just say we have another episode similar to this one, just to narrow it down for you for an answer. And we have another epidemic type thing. It happens. It could be anything. Name the disaster. We've got to do better. So it happens again, and we are seeing the same kind of things happen where we have certain businesses, churches, whatever they may be, are being shut down or, you know, suppressed in the sense of, you know, how many people can attend, those kinds of things. Would you advise the governor to continue to do what we did this last time? Maybe this is the best way to ask it. Or would you advise a different approach based on what we saw happen, how certain businesses were impacted, others were not, and it seemed to be a bit of an unequal application of the due process for one business? And I go back to, if an alcohol business can stay open or a marijuana business, how was the church shut down? Things like that. What would your opinion, your advisory opinions be to the governor the next time we face something?
Senator Schauer, through the chair, I think that we're going to have a clearer picture on some of these very issues that we're discussing. I think there are many cases making their way through the courts, not necessarily in Alaska, but in a lot of different states on these very subjects that very well determine at what, you know, when can the state action impede these rights that we enjoy as citizens, right? And so I think there's going to be a lot more clarity in the law when it comes to something like an epidemic. I'm hopeful that you all as a body, again, can address some of those issues through the statutory legislative process. And I the one thing that I would advise the governor on is to allow law to be more involved at the very beginning of the process rather than at the tail end of the process. And you know, it wasn't always an ideal situation, the timing of how much time we had to review these things. And I think if we were involved more at the beginning, we could have probably put together a better product, a better mandate. And I know that when I say that there are attorneys within the Department of Law that sort of were on the onset of drafting these. But what I would like to do is have that sort of constitutional view, that whole view from the very beginning of the process. And that would be the recommendation that I would make to the governor if we face the same issue down the road.
So, yeah, as you know, this is really important. It's been probably one of the most interesting and difficult years ever in the history of Alaska, in my opinion. A lot of our kids are struggling. I mean, you guys shut down private schools, basically. I mean, there's so many things in these mandates. It's unbelievable. Things just transformed, essential versus non-essential, you know, but people who are providing, their job is essential to them. So I just am tremendously not a fan of the governor's picking winners and losers, and I think you guys went way too far in pretty much all these. But
Senator Rambo, may I address that?
Sure.
So, you know, looking at it, there hasn't been a statewide mandate from the governor's office addressing the average citizen in Alaska since May. And, you know, the only one that really affected the most people, you know, we had specific provisions for very specific industries, such as the commercial fishing industry, given its vital nature to the economic viability of certain parts of the state. But the one that most people were familiar with was, you know, coming into the airport and having to test. And even that's discretionary now. An individual may get tested or they may not get tested. And again, that's been since May. So there's been a considerable amount of time without an overreaching, controlling mandate from the governor of the state of Alaska.
Yeah, that's your interpretation. I understand that. But to me, I was at the time, I was texting, actually, Governor, in regards to Reopen Alaska. We had a huge rally with Reopening Alaska on April 22nd. Interestingly, he ended up opening Alaska on April 22nd. But these had D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K. This is basically the blueprint that has set the stage. And you go around to businesses, I found three this weekend that still had mandate 16 up. So it's impacting, whether you want to admit it or whether you not, it has impacted all of us. Lives are still being changed. I mean, look at us, you know, in these we're still taking PCR tests. We're being screened when we come in here. We're wearing these on our face. So I would consider, you know, it is still impacting a lot. There's special areas like Mat-Su that were a little smarter, and I think Kenai and Fairbanks, I think, was less. But the governor's had a pretty heavy hand in the big picture. But I really want to get back to the questions. I'm going to ask one more here, and then I'm going to get to some other members and then come back. But I'm going to drill down. Have you looked at the subtle law? And I, in particular, wanted your input on the Juho versus Williamson. Are you familiar with that, or would you like me to refresh your memory?
Senator Imhol, I don't remember the particulars.
Okay, so this one, basically,
case.
This one, it's in 1900, a public health official's quarantine an entire district of San Francisco containing a population of more than 15,000 people to contain the epidemic of the bubonic plague. The quarantine was made to operate exclusively against the Chinese community. The court held that the quarantine was unconstitutional on the grounds that it was unfair. The health authorities acted with an evil eye and an unequal hand. Juho serves as a reminder that quarantine can be used as an instrument of prejudice and impact the vulnerable individuals or populations. So where we're going with this potentially is the vaccines. We're starting to see some areas with these vaccines where you may be able to get services if you have them and you may not. So after refreshing your memory on this, tell me what you're thinking in regards to this, how important this case was.
Senator Imhol, I think the court got it right, obviously, in that case, that you can't target a specific group of people in your management of the disaster itself, right? Did I answer your question, Senator?
So basically where I'm going to go with this, would you as Attorney General protect and defend the right not to get the mRNA vaccine and not have it be part of a employment or part of, if there's arbitrary where you're allowed to have services with the vaccine and you're not allowed to not to?
Senator Imhol, the policy call that the governor's repeated over and over again is that it's his intent not to force people to get the vaccine. He has made it entirely voluntary. Now, whether or not private businesses require it for their employees, that is another consideration in and of itself. And there's some case law on that subject. And I would in response to those issues, I would follow the law, follow the case law, and that's how I'd approach addressing those situations.
Madam Chair, a comment?
Go ahead.
I just want to say, and I know you are the Chair, Senator Reinbold, I'm quite satisfied, and you manage the time, I don't. We're halfway through the hearing, and we pretty much focused on COVID. I have quite a few other questions on those topics I was hoping to get to. I know we have two bills up as well. And I just want to mention also that private schools, there was never a mandate to shut down private schools. In fact, many of them stayed open and did very well. So just wanted to get that comment on the record.
Okay, well, if you read the mandates, you'll see what's in there. So I have them right before me, and I'm not going to get in a debate with a former judiciary chair in regards to this, but there was clear mandates regarding that. But I'd like to stick with this topic right now. I warned people that I talked to the President McChickie and told him that there was a good chance we weren't going to get to his bill, but we're certainly going to try. But this is one of the most important confirmations. I believe that this is one of the most important issues that have faced Alaska certainly in my history, and I think it's important. A lot of people are suffering. There's a lot of students that are suffering. There are business sufferings. There's a lot of confusion. This is our first opportunity. So I think I'm really thankful that you came before us. I genuinely am. And this vaccine issue is very, very important. So basically, you understand that it requires informed consent and that these cannot be mandated under emergency use authorization. The mRNA vaccines, you understand that, correct, according to federal law?
Senator Imhol, like I indicated before, my intent as I review any question about vaccine use would be to look at the stated law and follow the law.
Okay, so we're going to go ahead, and I think who had the next question? Was it Senator Keel? Did you have a question?
On another topic, Madam Chair.
On another topic, yep, we're ready to move on to the next topic.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Taylor, thanks for this colloquy. I had another separation of powers question, and I think you and I have had conversations where I think it's we aren't going to come to an agreement on the merits of the state's lawsuits related to the Janus case, but the separation of powers question doesn't go to the merits of that case. It goes to how the executive branch has been funding its efforts in that case, and last year the legislature established a budget structure that limited how much could be spent on outside consultants rather than the considerable resources and tremendous expertise within your department. It's my understanding that the Department of Law has continued to spend well in excess of that limit, and so I would appreciate your thoughts on how the executive branch can, under our separation of powers and the legislature's power of appropriation, continue to do that.
Senator Keel, through the chair, I agree with you 100% that this is definitely a separation of powers issue. Obviously, I didn't make those decisions to get involved in the litigation. I didn't make those decisions to continue to use outside counsel. But what I can tell you is that under the separation of powers, the Alaska Supreme Court has made it very clear that the Attorney General has the ability to bring litigation that he or she views to be in the public interest. And I think that is exactly what occurred with my two prior predecessors. I also am aware of the sort of the confinement clause, which you can't use an appropriations bill to administer a state program. And I think there might also be issues with that. That being said, I have asked the Department of Law, I have asked to fully review those decisions and to make a recommendation to me so that I can decide how the Department of Law will continue on that subject. Very well could receive an opinion and ultimately decide that yeah, we need to look at that appropriations restriction and stop the practice of what's been going on. And I'm fully willing to do that if that's what the law states. Again, I've asked that for that opinion, and when I receive that opinion, I intend to fully review it and make that decision independent of what my predecessors have decided.
Thank you.
Okay, and I'm going to clarify something. Health Mandate 13, it said the statewide school closure of all K-12 public and private schools is being extended from May 1st, 2020 to the end of the 2019 school year. So I've studied these very hard. I just want to make sure we get that on the record. With that, Senator Myers, did you have a question?
Thank you. Mr. Attorney General, so we've seen a lot of law and executive orders coming out of D.C. over the last couple of months here, and I would just like to hear some of your department's efforts, a little bit more detail about what is being done to push back against some of that executive overreach.
Yeah, Senator Myers, through the chair, I'm glad to respond to that because I think it's essential that we respond to that. I believe firmly that over the next 4 years, the very economic viability of the state is at risk. And that's part of the reason why we have a budget proposal that'll provide us additional attorneys to help address that issue. It's actually a budget, I shouldn't say additional attorneys, because the idea would be to utilize outside counsel when it's necessary on these issues. Once we have several sections that sort of address those issues, and we intend to fully utilize those to address the issues. But we expect that there will be a time when we can no longer address additional issues, given that the attorneys and the staff working on those issues their time is consumed on prior issues, right? And so part of that appropriation is designed so that we'll have that flexibility if needed to utilize outside counsel. Part of that appropriation is to provide the science necessary to litigate some of those issues. And your question was also, what have we done? And I think we've done quite a bit as a as a department to sort of review the EOs. A lot of what occurs in those EOs eventually goes down to the agencies, and the agencies engage in a rulemaking process. We'll fully engage in those rulemaking process, and if there's rules that we think violate the law or the Constitution or what was promised to Alaska at statehood, then we're going to address those likely through litigation. But as of now, we are part of a suit that was filed in Louisiana that talks about the moratorium on leasing for offshore and onshore oil and gas exploration. We are intervening in a Montana case that addresses those EOs in a little bit different perspective, and we also intend to intervene in a Wyoming case that looks at whether or not the EOs violated the administrative procedures that the president is bound by. And so we're engaging on the EOs. Like I said, it's a little bit of a limited engagement on the EOs because they haven't been turned into law yet, and the law is where we really will have to take a close look in the rulemaking process to make sure that A, they follow the procedures for the rulemaking, and B, once the law comes out, we address issues as they arise.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to make it quick for time. It's fallen up, and Senator Myers stole a bit of my thunder. It's about federal overreach, but a few specifics. Things like, we're looking at H.R. 1 that they may or may not pass, admittedly, but you have, which would be a significant impact on states' voter, our rights to determine how we do our own elections, possible orders, about the Second Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, to be securing your properties. A lot of state right issues with this. We have other things like navigable waters, ANWR, NPRA, and other things that are potentially coming down. So I guess the broader question for me is, what is your intent on pushing back to what we would consider federal overreach? And so, like I said, this kind of dovetails into what Senator Myers asked you. Do you intend to fight back and stop it? And I heard you say litigation. That's certainly a part of it. Advising the governor on how we would, engage with the administration to stop those things. And then perhaps legislation we file to try to stop some of those things. Would it be something that you're going to engage in from the administration point of view as well to help us do that? Because I would anticipate there's going to be pushback on those that would stop that. So I guess the broader question is, do you intend to be, as the Attorney General, not only advising the governor, but actively engaged in protecting the state's individual rights, which is what makes us unique as a nation? One size does not fit all approach. What works here doesn't work in California or Florida or New York or somewhere else. So what is your intent as the Attorney General on trying to make sure that Alaska is allowed to be Alaska and the square peg is not pushed into a round hole on federal overreach on certain issues that we know we already face? And moving forward, it might be worse. Yep. Thank
Senator,
you.
Senator Schauer, through the chair, great question. Yes. In short, yes, absolutely, emphatically, we will be engaged. We'll fight the fight to protect statehood rights. A good example of that, to talk about the Tongass roadless rule, for example. Tongass roadless rule occurred under the Trump administration, and there's been a legal challenge to that exemption from the Tongass Forest of the roadless rule, and we've intervened in that action, and we're going to take every step the challenge is going to be keeping track of all the moving parts, right? And that's where I think our partnerships that we have with other like-minded states. There's a lot of other states. We're not the only state, although we are to the greatest extent, that have a lot of federal lands within our states, or that have a lot of resources that make it economically viable to live and raise a family in Alaska. And so we are constantly in contact with those other states. We're making them aware of issues as we see them. They're making aware of us. So we're trying to multiply in a way that's wise, to utilize the resources that we do have, the budget that we do have, the attorneys that we do have, by working with the other states that have like-mindedness. We're hopefully going to be able to address each and every issue as it comes up, and we'll have the resources to do it.
Two other senators, we have a very engaged committee, okay? This happens a lot. So if you guys could pick it real tight, Jesse, or Senator Kill, I'm sorry, and then real tight, Senator Hughes, in regards to they both have it at this point. Senator Kill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Taylor, a different resource issue. There is a major contamination issue across our state. from PFAS. I won't try and pronounce what those chemicals are because I usually get it wrong. And the contamination in people's drinking water around the state largely comes from firefighting foams that, when used exactly as directed, poison the water. Have you worked or will you work with the DEC commissioner and the Department of Environmental Conservation to address some of the tremendous costs that these are imposing on the state of Alaska and the burdens on DEC staff?
Senator Kill, through the chair, that's a great question and a great concern of many people that live in this great state, those that are located near those airports and where some of the PFAS foam testing took place. We are currently, and I've got to be careful how I answer this because we are currently engaged in litigation on the subject. We have two pieces of litigation that the state's been sued on that very issue, and we have engaged in a suit against the manufacturers of PFAS. And so it's a complicated issue. It's a resource-intensive issue in that it's going to require experts, which are expensive. I mean, we work the best we can with DEC and with DNR on these issues, but likely we're going to have to engage outside experts on this. Outside studies are going to have to be done. And it's going to be a long, slow process as we work our way through the litigation. But I'm hopeful that the outcome will be in the best interest of the residents of this great state.
Senator Hughes?
Yes, and as far as the different suits regarding overreach, Louisiana, Montana, Wyoming, you mentioned, there's also there was a letter led by the AG in West Virginia back in January, then two just here recently, one March 8th, one March 16th. The March 8th was regarding overreach as far as the president's power to relegate, and maybe that was the one that was Missouri, and then the Keystone, I believe Montana. Texas, and maybe we were one of the 21 states. But bringing it really close to home, the Clean Power Act, Alaska and Hawaii has been exempted from that. And in the new administration, we may not be so lucky. So I'm just wondering if the Department of Law is making any preparation in that regard, because as you mentioned before, we're taking hits from a number of directions, and this would be one more.
Yeah, no, Senator Hughes, through the chair, this is a really critical issue for the state, because you're exactly right. We were exempt from many of the provisions of the Clean Power Act. When the court struck down the changed scheme under the Trump administration, they left it open to whether or not we went back to that Clean Power Act or whether or not there was something else, and we're still unclear about what rules are actually governing us at this moment. But the Biden administration has made it abundantly clear that their intent isn't to go back to the Obama-era rules, that they intend to come up with their own rules, which we expect to be sort of a 2.0 of the Clean Power Act. And so, again, we don't know whether Alaska is going to be exempt. Obviously, we're going to push to make that happen. But that, again, is sort of where we're at with that issue. But we are very closely monitoring that issue.
Thank you for that. And Madam Chair, if you would allow time before we close out, I would love to hear his ideas for reducing the sexual crimes in the state. That's one of his priorities. And as you know, we worked as a Judiciary Committee a couple of years ago on that. And so I would, if you would provide that time for him
right.
to talk about that,
and
I would appreciate it.
Just so you know, it doesn't have to be over today. We can invite him back. You know, there's a lot of, this is the, I would consider this one of the most, if not the most important appointee, and I'm not going to rush it through. So, you know, we can have him back. I think that's, I've talked to him personally in regards to this issue. I met with him at the airport, what was it, like 3 weeks ago, when we were discussing if you had any input, whether you helped write that letter, which you said you did, in regards to the governor. Is that correct, the letter the governor directed at me?
Yeah, Senator Reinbold, like most of the things that become public from the governor's office, we do make a review of those before they become public.
Correct. Okay. So when you confirmed that, when I saw you at the airport, we also discussed, one of my concerns was you don't have a criminal background in regards to criminal law prosecution and things like that. And so that's a really important issue. And yes, that is on the agenda, but we're not there yet. So I'm going to go ahead and just touch bases in regards to the letter real quickly. It says that the governor may proclaim martial law when the public safety requires in case of rebellion, actual or imminent invasion. Martial law shall not continue for longer than 20 days without the approval of the majority of the members of the legislature in joint session. I never stated that the governor declared martial law. It was in. It was never my intent to say that. What I basically was referring to was that in regards to what I think you guys got mixed up about was that there were 14 pages of regulations and statutes that you guys suspended, and there were so many mandates, but you never declared martial law. So I don't know how that all got confused on you guys' end, but that was a pretty significant allegation. And I would ask if you would work with me in regards to getting that letter retracted, because none of it, in my opinion, is substantiated. I don't know if I can ask you to do that or not, but I'm, you know, you don't have to answer that question, okay? But as Attorney General for all Alaskans, it's a letter I'd like retracted.
Senator Rambold, understood.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so my next question is, do you acknowledge by law and the separation of power that the legislative body has the sole power granted by the state constitution to create law, and the executive branch is to uphold and execute Alaskan law? The executive branch executes. Do you agree with that statement?
Senator Rambold, that is the principal responsibility of the legislative branch is to enact law. And it is the principal responsibility of the executive to enforce that law.
So this will be a yes or a no. Do you acknowledge by law and the separation power that the legislative body has the sole power granted by the state constitution to create law, and the executive branch is in place to uphold and execute Alaska law?
Senator Rambold, there's some checks and balances in that process, as you're fully aware. So I agree with the statement in general, but I think there are checks and balances in place. The governor does have a veto power that he or she uses from time to time, and that I think does address what laws are become laws. And so with a qualified yes, I believe that is the general nature of the relationship between the legislature and the executive branch.
Senator Keel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Another topic that goes to the relationship between the branches, and it has to do with the constitutional provision that sweeps funds. That's our shorthand at the end of a fiscal year to the constitutional budget reserve. A couple of years ago, there was the possibility of a reinterpretation from the executive branch about which funds are subject to that. So it's a two-part question. I seem to keep doing that, but it saves me the follow-up. Mr. Taylor, do you agree with the multi-decade view that the power cost equalization endowment is not subject to that sweep? And I guess the second part of the question is separated from the PCE. Would you commit, when there is the potential for a reinterpretation of a longstanding understanding between the branches, to communicate with the legislature about that?
Senator Keel, in answer to your first question, in my one-on-ones with multiple legislators, that is an issue that has come up. And what I told them at that time was that I would take another look at that issue to find out what the Department of Law opinion is on that. And we're currently in that review process as we speak, so I can't speak to how I come down currently on that issue. I want to finish that review process and look through the information and then come to that conclusion. And then as far as working with the legislature on those issues, that's my personality type. That's how I've always engaged in the practice of laws. I like to talk through issues. I like to work through issues. I think the last thing, the last course of action should be sort of this litigation stance that we sometimes jump to a little too quickly. On those issues that I am able to have those discussions with the legislature, I'm happy to have those. Obviously, on some of those occasions, it's probably a policy call that needs to be made. And again, I'm not an elected official, so I don't make those policy calls. And so I'd rely on the instruction that I was given from the client, whether it be DEC, whether it be Fish and Game, or whether it be the chief executive.
Okay, so do you believe I thought it was in regards to the question that I asked you in regards to the legislative branch having the authority to make law. So I'm going to ask it in a little bit different way. Do you believe that either the judicial or executive branches of our state government have any lawmaking authority under the Alaska Constitution?
Senator Rambold, no.
Thank you. As Attorney General of Alaska, if asked to resolve questions concerning the constitutional legal authority of the governor to issue executive orders limiting public and private gatherings, closing or imposing restrictions upon businesses, and regulating a broad variety of other aspects of the day-to-day lives of Alaskan citizens for the greater good of the people, what might be the foundations that you would consider such fundamental issues?
Senator Rambold, I'm having a little trouble understanding the question. Could you please repeat that question?
So basically, as Attorney General of Alaska, if asked to resolve questions concerning the constitutional and legal authority of the governor to issue executive orders limiting public and private gatherings, as he did in the mandates, closing and imposing restrictions upon certain businesses, as he did, and regulating the broad variety of other aspects of the day-to-day lives of Alaska citizens, as happened, for the alleged greater good of the people, what might the foundations for your consideration of such fundamental issues? So when you're advising him.
So, Senator Rambold, I mean, your question sort of clarifies your initial question, which I answered no. In the Disaster Declaration Act, obviously the legislative branch deferred some of their lawmaking authority, is how I view it, because I view the mandates have the force of law, to the governor in certain situations. In those situations, it's laid out in the act. Either, it has to be certified by Commissioner Crum or for the Adjutant General, and then a decision made by the governor. And so as I review the ability of the governor to do that, I would look to the Alaska Disaster Act itself. What does it say on the topic? If there's no clear answer there, I would go to case law through the state of Alaska. If there's nothing there, then I would go outside the state, look at case law to figure out what the best advice to the governor would be on any given situation. And again, with this disaster declaration and the pandemic that we saw, there were a lot of areas of first impression. So those areas of first impression are sort of the really important areas, right? Because if it's decided law, I know exactly what advice to give the governor, and it's very clear on what advice I give to the governor. But on areas of first impression, we make the best call. And I give the best advice that I can to the governor based upon what we do know, and then it's up to the governor to heed that advice or move in a different direction.
Okay, so do you believe that the proclaimed emergency powers of the governor as it pertains to the current mandates or the mandates that were currently in place, resulting in the direct deprivation of rights, is compatible or incompatible with the Constitution?
I believe that it is compatible with the Constitution, with the case law that we have before us, and the statutory framework in which we work.
So do you believe that the Constitution of the State of Alaska and the Constitution of the United States of America is the supreme law of the land?
Absolutely.
So if there's conflict there, where would you default?
I would defer to the Constitution.
Okay, thank you. Just a second. Senator Showers.
So thank you, Madam Chair. Just in line with that, if we back up to the previous question, because I get a little behind on the questions moving on here, is that it sounds like you're saying this, and I would understand why, so put it in context, that part of the problem was that we often delegate authority to the administration for different things, and we've done that with law. We certainly did that with the bill last March. When we passed it, we delegated a lot of authority. And this is maybe a little bit tenuous for you, and so I understand. That's why I put this in context. It sounds like what you're saying is part of it was our fault, in the sense of, and that's why I said this may be tenuous for you to answer, and it's okay to me, is that we delegated authority and then we took ourselves out of the game because we did not have any other ability to operate remotely or otherwise and never got back together again. So this circles back to the lessons learned out of this. So in one sense, is that kind of a true statement, what you're saying? And like I said, I understand context. I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but it seems like we did this in some ways. We allowed this to happen by what we passed and handed off to the administration. Now, they didn't have to do it all this way, and maybe things should have been done differently in certain areas. But what would your assessment be as we're moving forward for that? Because it seems like we may have been a part of the problem.
Senator Schauer, through the chair, I think when the Alaska Declaration, the Disaster Declaration Act was passed, there was an acknowledgement that the legislative power by its very nature is slow. It rumbles forward at a very slow pace most of the time. It takes a lot of time to get consensus among the different legislators. And so I think the Alaska Disaster Act is acknowledgement that sometimes in certain conditions that sort of needs to be bypassed for a moment to deal with the disaster at hand. And so could the Disaster Act be fine-tuned? Sure, absolutely it could be. Was the legislature ultimately responsible for passing the Alaska Disaster Act? Yes, that's an absolute yes on that as well. Does that answer your question?
Follow-up.
It does, and I know another one had a question to my left. So in your opinion, back to opinion, do you believe that part of the problem was we let it go on too long as the legislature versus being involved?
Senator Schauer, through the chair, I think an option for the legislature is always to remain silent. That is one of the rights that you have as a legislator, is to not engage in an issue and to not take on an issue. And I can't argue with any decision that the body made, the Senate or the House made, to not engage directly on that issue. And so I think that the ability not to engage is just as important as your ability to engage. And so I think that the legislature made a policy call there and moved in the direction they thought best for the state of Alaska.
Thank you.
So in regards to that, I'm gonna stick with the question. So do you believe that the proclaimed emergency powers of the governor as it pertains to the mandates by the governor resulting in the direct deprivation of rights is compatible or incompatible with the Constitution? You answered that you believed that they were compatible. Is that correct?
Senator Reinbold, yes, I did answer that.
Okay, correct. And obviously we see it different, and I know tons of lawyers see it differently. So I just wanted definitely – I started Constitutional Freedom Fighters, and I found – tremendous amount of constitutional violations. So I think that's important to get on the record. It said he thinks that, you know, Senator Schauer just said something about, you know, is it the legislature's fault? Well, I'll tell you, we three were acknowledged a no vote in regards to the disaster declaration. So that's important for you, you know, to get on the record. I will not take any responsibility for what the governor did, and I do not believe it's the legislature's fault. So I want to make it clear that I didn't get asked a single health alert, a single mandate. We didn't get called back in. He wasn't taking my phone calls, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not going to take any responsibility for the chaos, and I also believe that the legislature has the sole authority in regards to writing laws, and it's for him to execute them. We did not write these mandates. So you know very, very well that I have had a very hard time with these mandates, and I think they crossed the line.
Madam Chair, can I clarify that, please?
Go ahead.
I just want to be clear on that. When I say legislature's fault, I'm not trying to say that we shouldn't have been engaged, is my point to that, just to make it clear. I'm not saying that, you know, I voted no on SB 41. I thought it was too much, and so I'll be clear for the record. You can go back and look it up. My point of saying that is that I believe the legislature should have been engaged from a number of things, and we didn't, and we never even had the chance later. So when I say that, I'm not necessarily putting on individual legislators. I'm saying that as a body, as I agree with Senator Reinbold, we have that legislative authority to do the things we did. We didn't do it. And so my question is to you, and you've answered it, and it's fine, but to be clear for the record, is that we did not do things we could have done and taken them up if we had a leadership body at the time that was engaged and wanted to do that. We could have, and we didn't. So I can't – I'm not going to talk about the governor, what he did and didn't do. I'm only going to talk about this body had the ability and the authority to act and did not. And that's important for the record because we took ourselves out of the game. And that's my point. So thank you for that.
And just a minute. So I want to make a point, too. It was very chaotic. He kept doing disaster declaration after disaster declaration. Travel was inhibited. I'm not going to blame the legislature. I'm going to make it very, very clear. I do not believe it is our fault. We had a leadership that was in transition, and the Capitol was very, very far away. And the governor could have engaged us in Anchorage, Wasilla, et cetera. So I'm going to state it very clear on the record that I am going to put this, you know, primarily in regards to the executive branch. He could have engaged, especially with the transformation of different people being elected, the president, the rules chair out. It was a confusing time for the legislature in regards to who actually was leading us at the time. Senator Keel, can you be quick, please?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. On specific to this topic, I'm a little concerned at the interpretation that in any case where the law says no action by the legislature ends something, the implication seems to be that if the legislature does not affirmatively act, the governor may fill that void with whatever action he chooses. That seems to be the principle I'm teasing out of the response to Senator Schauer and the chair, and that concerns me very much. Of course, the governor had the power to convene the legislature. The state capitol, of course, is extremely close. We're sitting in it. And so the governor, in electing not to exercise that constitutional power, I mean, that power wasn't lost on the drafters of the Alaska Disaster Act. They had read the Constitution. The governor, in electing not to do that, set up a statutory consequence and acted instead contrary to that statutory consequence. So can you explain to me the principle under which you're operating?
Senator Keel, thank you through the chair. Thank you for the opportunity to clarify that, because I did not mean to indicate that legislative inaction always results in the ability of any other player, any other actor, whether it be the judiciary or the executive, to act in any way that they want. Obviously, there's some instances where legislative inaction does have the result of I want to be careful my words because I'm trying to think of the scenarios in which that occurs, but does involve the inaction in of itself is an act that has the force of law. And so I didn't mean to imply that any time that the legislature cedes the field that it allows carte blanche by any other executive or judiciary actor.
I have a clarification about 241.
Okay, just one second. I want to ask him a question first. Are you willing to come back before the Judiciary Committee?
Senator Reinbold, I would be happy to come back before this committee.
Okay, because I really do think as we talked in the airport and as Senator Hughes brought up and we've worked, I think that criminal law is so important, and I want to know your plan. I really do, and I think the rest of us would like to do that too. I'm going to only give about two more minutes for this because I really want to get the bill read across. President McChickie has been sitting here patiently, and I really want to get that bill read across. So can you be very tight because I have one closing
question? Yes, I just want to clarify on the record for 241. My dad passed away, so I wasn't actually on the floor. I did have some concerns, and I believe you, Senator Reinbold, were also not present. So I just didn't want to misrepresent that on the record. And I actually do agree that both executive branch and the legislative branch bears responsibility. The Disaster Act has been on the books for, I'm assuming, decades, and several of us have been here for a number of years. We could have taken any opportunity to make adjustments, and we didn't. So I'm not afraid to bear part of that responsibility, and we do learn from our mistakes. We're human, we're flawed, and I'm just grateful that you're willing to work with us to try to improve that for the next time. And I look forward to that, because actually when I read the duties of the AG and statute, it is to give us some advice and respond to what we might be proposing. So I thank you for your willingness to do that.
Senator Hughes, happy to do that.
So in regards to that, when you don't vote, it's a no. It's registered as a no. And so we did not vote yes on this. I had very, very deep concerns with 241. And I made it very, very, very clear in regards to that, and I still obviously do. In regards to the final question that I'm going to ask you today, and then I thank you so much for being willing to come back, but if confirmed, will you review and evaluate during extraordinary times, such as disaster declarations, to make sure that all the rules that the governor puts forth are based on the law, and the law is based on protecting civil liberties for the good of the people of the state of Alaska?
Senator Reinbold, you've described my job description. That's exactly what I am tasked to do, and I intend to do it to the full to my utmost ability.
Excellent. And with that, thank you so much for being with us. We really look forward to talking about criminal law. That's such an issue near and dear to all of our hearts. And so thank you for coming again before us. And it really was a privilege to have you Attorney General appointee at Trade Clerk for the Judiciary Committee today.
Thank you, Senator Reinbold. If I may, there was some invited testimony that was calling in for today. I don't know if they're still or not on the line.
Okay. All righty. Do you know exactly who that was?
Yes, that should be Sheldon Fisher and Mike Garrity.
Sheldon Fisher. Okay, so Senator McChicky, I'm going to have to say I'm really sorry in regards to this. Do you know if they can call back, or do you want to just go ahead and take them right now?
Senator Reinbold, that's completely within your...
Let's see if they can do it. Oh, it says Sheldon is unavailable right now. Attorney General Garrity's on. Let's go ahead and take him, and then I'm going to... Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and open public testimony. And with that, former Attorney General Mike Garrity, would you like to make a few comments? If you could keep them tight, that would be appreciative. And I certainly had a great time engaging with you when you were at Attorney General. You're very interesting. So please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Garrity. I'm an attorney practicing in Anchorage. I've been an active attorney in the state for almost 43 years. I had the honor and privilege of serving as Attorney General for the state beginning in 2012 through 2014 for then Governor Parnell. I also have the privilege of knowing and working with some of the members of this committee, and I thank you all for your service. I hired Trey Taylor out of law school in 2004. He worked as an associate at our firm for approximately 5 years, and I had occasion to work with him closely on a number of different matters in litigation, including trials. He was a hard worker, very good attorney, and a valued member of our firm. He was always had an interest in business, and he did leave after 5 years for a private sector in-house position, and we were sorry to see him go. I was pleased for Trek when the governor announced his appointment. I've always known him to be an honest and ethical attorney, and I had plenty of occasion to observe him in that regard over the course of 5 years. I also observed someone with strength of character. I would never question Trek's desire or commitment to do the right thing and to seek whatever input and guidance he needs to determine the right thing. Wisdom is having the confidence to recognize your own limitations and to ask the right questions. Nobody comes into this job knowing all the answers. As AG, he has the considered resources of the Department of Law to help him with those decisions, and there would be no hesitation by him, in my opinion, to draw on that knowledge and experience to assist him in the discharge of his duties. I've not listened to all the public testimony concerning Treg's appointment, but I will state that attacks on his character or ethics are unwarranted and malicious. I know he is honored by this appointment, and I know he would never do anything to either tarnish the office of Attorney General or the Department of Law. I endorse his appointment without any qualifications, and I urge the committee to confirm him. Thank you.
Thank you, former Attorney General Garrity. We really appreciate you taking your time today. Great comments, and thank you for being with us today. I'm going to go ahead and continue with some of this public testimony right now that it's open. Sheldon is not available right now, and I'm going to ask the committee if we can have a special meeting next week in regards to, since Senator McChicky was here, I'm going to try to make some special arrangements next week, okay? And so I promise I will get with you. I'm going to get with the committee as soon as possible and try to have a special meeting for this, okay? In regards to, I'm going to go ahead and go down the list. Charles McGee, you have 2 minutes.
Yes, is my line unmuted?
It's unmuted.
Okay, I had sent in 3 pages via fax LIO from the Anchorage LIO to this committee in regards to this hearing, and I'd like to have the individual review this information. And I was listening to the comments about my question was I was listening to the issue regarding executive orders, and I'm involved in a situation where an employee of the federal government as well as the state had wrote a notice to cure and was turned into the court in my regard to my case. I found that out later. That's a violation of due process when the agent was working for both the executive office of the presidency as well as the governor's office. And then when the governor texts the statewide all employees, she indeed received the text. So she was on, she was employed by the state. In fact, she took a sabbatical from the Department of Corrections in Seward because her son was arrested for federal and state charges. So she took on me as a charge to mitigate her personal endeavors with her son.
Okay, Charles, can you wrap up? Your 2 minutes is up, and I'll make sure that the committee gets your comments. So, and just state your name on the record, please.
My name is part of the record that I sent in. I'm the beneficiary of the McKee Trust.
Okay, got it. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, we'll make sure your comments are sent around. Next on the list is Andre McLeod.
Hello.
You have 2 minutes. Thank you for being with us, and thank you for your patience, Andre. Please go ahead.
State
your name first.
Any attack on Mr. Taylor's character? When
Ma'am, can you state your name clearly?
My name is Andre McLeod, and I work at ACPERG as a good government director, and I take some offense with Mr. Garrity's statements that these might be attacks on integrity and they're malicious when in fact they are facts. So if I could start. Trek Taylor has already come before the House Judiciary Committee twice. Those meetings were stunning. Mr. Taylor's statements made clear that he ought not to be confirmed as Alaska's Attorney General because of his insistence to misconstrue our laws, violate the public trust and interest, and betray the people of Alaska. Although he promises the sun, the moon, and the stars, his actions and repeatedly stated positions related to the Ben Stevens jump from the governor's office to ConocoPhillips reveals that either he doesn't understand our laws or he actually does understand them and has purposefully, willfully, and intentionally chosen to contradict them. The laws are clear. They're pretty simple, too. The Executive Branch Ethics Act restricts certain activities for employees who worked in the governor's office when they leave state service. It mandates restrictions, either 2 year or 1 year. And if a governor waives those restrictions, there is a process for that. And it has to be done in writing. A copy of the written waiver is submitted to the Attorney General for approval or disapproval. Unfortunately, that was not done with Ben Stevens. When questioned about the non-existence of a written waiver, Mr. Taylor continues to contradict our laws, digs his heels in deeper, and insists it's unnecessary until such a time when Ben Stevens thinks he has a conflict and he'll contact the state about obtaining a waiver. Mr. Taylor's logic is totally laughable if it did not relate to the fundamental dynamics of corruption in state government. Many former employees have put in for these waivers. They took their to heart their oaths to do right by the public, and they served and did follow our laws regarding written waivers. They knew that appearances of conflicts of interest existed and took them seriously. They knew the reason for those waiting periods because they read, understood, and respected the law. Oftentimes we think of corruption as money changing hands. With Mr. Taylor, we see corruption happening right under our noses. When Mr. Taylor misconstrues laws put on the books to protect the public interest and prevent and mitigate conflicts of interest, that's corruption.
Okay.
After the 2006 FBI raid of legislative offices,
legislators
took great pains to right the wrongs that occurred because of the actions of corrupt public officials.
Okay, your time is up. Thank you very much for being with us today. If you want to submit comments, please do so. Thank you very much. We're just under a very tight time crunch. Committee members, can we stay 5 or 6 minutes? Are you okay with that, just to get the people online? Teresa Obermeyer, you are next. If you could be real tight with your comments, the committee sure would appreciate it because we are past our time. State your name and affiliation, please.
Reinbold, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Senator, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Okay, I did submit a written statement, and I listed, and I do not support Mr. Taylor for Alaska Attorney General, and I certainly agree with Ms. McLeod. It is certainly not impugning his character or anything. I don't know this gentleman, but he seems to have no limits. Anything goes. His main theme is good people do bad things. If he is supported and confirmed as Attorney General, he will have 300 attorneys working under him. Does no one have any limits? Truly, Chairman Reinholt and State Judiciary Committee, these people have no limits. I look at the three high-ranking attorneys, and that is Kevin Clarkson, this Mr. Sneeden, and Ethan Berkowitz. None of them have even been disciplined by the Alaska Bar Association. Mr. Taylor is a member of the Alaska Bar Association. He individually should go and say, why haven't you disciplined these three attorneys? You know, I think Ms. McLeod covered a lot of the issues about Ben Stevens. I actually quoted Alaska Statute 39.52.180, restrictions on employment after leaving state service. I hope that people will look at that. And I just really want to lastly say apologies. Mr. Taylor actually left the House Judiciary Committee last Friday. Is he this important? Unless his wife had been killed in an automobile accident or something very grave had happened, I can't understand. It showed me he has no respect for public office. And very much apologies. I'm glad if Mr. Taylor is here today, because I don't talk about people behind their back. And on Friday, I had to because he had left the hearing. So thank you for hearing me, Senator Reinbold, and hope that you will not confirm Mr. Taylor.
Okay, next we have David Carter.
Hello, my name is David Carter, and I am a retired attorney. I live in Anchorage, Alaska. Alaskans want and deserve honesty, integrity, and transparency from our elected officials and senior executive branch officials, such as attorneys general. Alaskans want legislators and attorneys general to easily recognize and reject the basic conflicts of interest that come with a revolving door of people moving from the oil industry to government, as Mr. Taylor did from ASRC to the AG's office, and from the Alaska executive branch, as Ben Stevens just did, going to ConocoPhillips. Ben Stevens, as we know, for the testimony of a senior executive with an oil industry subcontractor, accepted $1,000 a week for some 4 years while sitting as an acting Alaska senator as a bribe. And Mr. Stevens has never disputed the bribe characterization. That is a red flag for everyone. Alaskans do not want to reward people like this or those who look the other way. Senator Schauer's debrief comments are very important. Alaskans never got their debrief as to how the Ben Stevens Vico bribe scandal could happen or how to fix things. So this, you know, this direct behind-the-scenes interference with Alaskans' Prudhoe Bay oil production tax policies would never happen again. Anyway, those are my comments for today. It's nothing personal, but Mr. Taylor should not be affirmed for our Attorney General due to these conflicts of interest. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us today. And I believe the final person on today is Julie Smith. Julie, if you could get your comments in 2 minutes or less, that'd be appreciated. Thank you.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can, loud and clear. State your name and affiliation, please.
Hello?
State your name and affiliation, please.
My name is Julie Smith, and I am calling on behalf of myself as a indigenous resident in the state of Alaska.
Please proceed with your testimony.
Okay. As I stated before, I am indigenous. I am Inupiaq, but I was raised in Fairbanks, Alaska, in the foster care system. My family has told me stories growing up about how racism has affected them from my grandparents being in the boarding schools that were basically committing genocide against our peoples, to my father and my mother struggling with dealing with the traumas of being raised in environments where they experienced real real racism that nobody can argue that it's not racism. However, the problem that I am facing today is the systemic racism, and that has always played a part in my family history. And systemic racism means that even when people who are working in the field are trying their very best to not be racist, the system is set up so that way the way things are perceived or the way they decide to handle certain laws being written, it will target people of color, such as Inupiaq, more than it would target the majority. And so one of the issues that I have is that Treg Taylor has recently discussed the recent shootings against the six Asian women who died when eight people had died. And he had said that the shooter was having a bad day, and he didn't think that there were racist reasons behind it. However,
can you go ahead and wrap your like can you that. Make a conclusion? Wrap your comments up, because your 2 minutes is up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Did you want to wrap up? I guess not. Okay. All right. So for now, we're going to go ahead and close public testimony. It looks like we got. We may have to open it back up if we miss somebody. I think we missed Sheldon. But anyway, for right now, with that, Attorney General appointee, thank you so much for being here. I'm going to get together and work with the group, whether it's extending Monday. I don't know what everyone's schedule is or having it in an evening. I really want to get you back up as soon as possible. And President McChickie, I'm going to put you first up on Monday, okay, because I really apologize. I did not. You just never know how things are going to go. But we do have a very, very engaged Judiciary Committee. And so with that, I'm going to rearrange the schedule and make sure that you're up first on Monday, okay? And with that, Attorney General appointee Treg, it was actually nice to have you before the committee today. We appreciate you being here. And this will be continued, okay?
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to go ahead, and as you guys know, Judiciary is, because of meetings back home, we're not going to be having Judiciary on Friday, but we're definitely going to be having it Monday. I'm going to come around to your offices today, and I'm going to try to figure out if we can extend, have an hour or so for the Attorney General. I will come around to your offices, or my staff will, okay? With that, we're going to go ahead and gavel out. Thanks, everyone, for your patience today. We're gaveling out at 3:13 p.m.